Live from the mansion. It's been a week. It's been a couple weeks. I hadn't been able to do it. I was busy last week. I'm very sorry to my fans out there. It was a busy week last week. And I didn't get to do the R&R cast on Thursday like I usually do. But tonight is a very special night. We're going to be joined shortly by Stephen Fante. I'm not really sure how to say his last name. We'll get into that. But he is the brand ambassador from Yellowstone Bourbon. It is a great bourbon. It is one of my wife's favorites. We make the Honey Hole. That's the one we make with Yellowstone Bourbon. That's our signature cocktail. It's the bourbon and then the honey simple. And it's a really good cocktail. You can make it at home. We'll go into how you make some of these cocktails with the Yellowstone bourbon later. But we're very excited about this one tonight. It has been a week. On Thursday night, we were having a party here. And then Friday, I woke up. And the city had issues. So it's been a week. We are joined by my pal here, fellow mustache aficionado as well. I had to grow mine out to feel like I fit in with the bourbon thing, you know? I feel like mustaches are big in the bourbon industry.
You got to have a mustache in the bourbon industry. It's just a protocol.
And I'm trying to fit in, right? I want to fit in. I want to, you know, I want to be cool with the bourbon people. So we're joined by Stephen. Is it Fante? How do you say your last name?
Fante.
All right. So we are, and Stephen is from Yellowstone Distillery. What is it? Limestone Branch, I think, is the proper name.
That is correct.
It's their Christian name for their distillery. But we call them Yellowstone. So I have, like, this is what we have at the mansion right now. We have the Select, and this is a blend of 4 and 7 year bourbons. There's also the Limited. This one's not available at the mansion, but my wife loves bourbon, and so I have gotten her this one before. Now it's in a square bottle, and then not available in Alabama yet. We have the Yellowstone hand selected right there, the hand picked collection. So those are the three products you got. You guys have more than just those three that, like, from Yellowstone. Okay. He's going to show off. Yeah. All right.
We got some Bowling and Birch back there and some minor case sherry cask rye.
Yeah.
Don't forget the minor case rye that's over my shoulder there. That's the number one selling thing in our gift shop.
Really?
Which tells me that all the visitors, about 50,000 visitors a year we get through that gift shop, taste what they want on our bar. They go out and they spend the money on Minor Case Rye.
Minor Case Rye. Okay. Is that available in Alabama?
It is.
Okay.
It's a little harder to find. You might have to ask your liquor store, you know, to carry it. It comes in six pack cases, but it's a sherry cask finished rye whiskey, which it's the cream sherry cask of Myers Winery in Cincinnati, Ohio. Myers happens to be the oldest winery in Ohio, and it happened to be John F. Kennedy's favorite cream sherry. Myers 44 cream sherry was served after every state dinner in the White House while JFK was president.
Okay.
That particular cream sherry cask gives it a fruit finish with a fruit nose.
Okay.
So it's real soft. It's 51% rye. So what do you have to be a rye whiskey? 51% or higher. So it's an introductory rye. 6 points higher in corn, and you would be a bourbon distillate. If you're a bourbon drinker and not a rye drinker, you're going to like this.
Okay. That goes into some of the things that I want to talk about.
Sweet.
So going with the Yellowstone, I see Yellowstone's a 75% corn, 13% rye and 12% malted barley.
That is the Limestone Branch Distillery mash bill. That is white heirloom corn.
Yeah.
We import it from all the way across the street.
In Iowa?
No, in Kentucky.
In Kentucky. So it's Kentucky corn, because they always talk about Iowa corn being like the best corn. Is Kentucky corn better?
Well, we've got a shit ton of corn in Kentucky, let me tell you. Indians taught us how to grow it. We've been growing it great ever since. I got yellow corn on the backside of our property, white heirloom corn across the street. And of course, just over there in Simpsonville, you got the Bloody Butcher corn that Nethery distillery, Jephtha Creed, carries. So in Kentucky, we have all sorts of varieties of corn. And of course, that's where bourbon kind of got its start. And higher corn contents in bourbon relate more toward Kentucky than anything. Because a high corn content was what we grew. We didn't grow the barley and the rye and the malt. We brought that in on buckboard and mule. So the majority of the old school stuff back in buckboard and mule days was made with high corn contents.
Nice. So you guys, high corn, it's typically like a lower corn content for a lot of other people. For the novice people out there,
I tell you, it gets more complex.
Because I'm a novice on this blending stuff.
It gets more complex than that. Are you familiar with a rectifier?
I have one of those. That's how I process the corn, right? Or is there something else you're talking about?
A rectifier is someone that does not own stills but owns a brand.
Okay.
So, in the history of Yellowstone, there's been two rectifiers.
Okay.
Taylor and Williams was not a distillery. Taylor and Williams was a rectifier. Okay. And Taylor Williams' president was Mike Dant.
Okay.
So Mike Dant got his juice from where? Cold Spring Distillery down in Gethsemane, Kentucky. See, Cold Spring Distillery was where Yellowstone was originally created.
Okay.
Okay. And so he would rectify his juice. So if we've got 7-year distillate in Yellowstone Select and a 4-year distillate in Yellowstone Select, the 4-year distillate is off our stills. The 7-year distillate is rectified juice. The second rectifier that owned the brand Yellowstone was Luxco Corporation back before they built Lux Row Distillery.
Right.
Before that, they were a non-producing agent. And now they are a producing agent with stills.
So when you were a non-producing agent, you were basically sourcing like MGP.
Yeah, MGP is a great example of somebody that sells their liquor to multiple people that may not have stills, but want a brand. And
so everything Yellowstone makes now is all made in house.
Well, 4-year distillate that's in the bottle, some of that 4-year distillate is from our stills.
Okay.
Some of that 4-year just used off of some rectified juice, and the 7-year is definitely a rectified juice, which means that it was done off a distillery in Kentucky many years ago, 7 years back, right? And those distilleries were all column stills. And if you know anything about blended scotch, you're going to understand what I'm trying to say. A blended scotch is done off a column still and a pot still. Bourbons are not typically done that way. Yellowstone bourbon is done that way. Yellowstone Select bourbon is done off a column and a pot still, giving it a complexity, and it has two different mash bills. It has the 75% white heirloom corn, 13% rye, the rest in malted barley that we produce, and then it has the previous mash bill of the previous distiller, which was 68% yellow corn, rye, and barley. So you have a phenomenally complex beverage in your hand when you're drinking Yellowstone Select.
Well, that's what we want. We want the complexities. And I think it bourbon is so, like, so I do cigars, right? And it's pretty easy, right? We do a lot of the same things. We put, you know, we have the, for cigars, we have the wrapper, the binder, and the filler. Those are our three, that's our mash bill, basically, right? And so, like, for my cigar, personally, we have a, it's got a Sumatra Oscuro wrapper. It's got Nicaraguan filler and a Honduran binder. And it's crazy because, like, all of my cigars, it doesn't matter. If you get a box of one of them at R&R, and if you get another one in Nicaragua or Honduras where they're rolled, they're going to taste the exact same. But bourbon, you can literally take barrel with the same components and the same everything that goes into it. You have barrel one going to produce a completely different taste, and barrel two is going to complete a taste vastly different a lot of times. And it's, you know, so wild to me how it's so much difference between the different barrels.
It is amazing. Now, you can tend to find similarities in barrels that are sequential, that have been on the same rick, that are in the same part of the rick house, and they've been in for the same amount of time. Those barrels come out very similar to each other. Okay. Yeah. But you go across the rick house and you pull a barrel from down lower, and you might get the funk. And if you get the funk is a unique flavor profile on the back end of the bourbon that tells you that that was on a lower rick of the barrel house. It had all the drippings from all the barrels above it, and it had all from the summertime when it's real hot in Kentucky, all those drippings get reactivated and just waft up right in and around the barrels and those lower ricks of the barrel houses. And it permeates those barrels, and you get a bit of a funk on the back end of it. And I love the funk. There's a lot of people that dislike the funk. Jimmy Russell,
there's a famous song, We Want the Funk, right?
Yeah, that's a true story. When you get a single barrel, you're wanting something unique. And when I come across one that has something unique, even if it is the funk, it's a characteristic that I tend to cherish.
So, like, when you're picking bourbon, what are the characteristics that you're looking for like you personally?
I like everything smoky. I always have. I was a tea sommelier many years ago, and I ran the tea program for a coffee company in town, and I imported a lot of teas, and one of the Lapsang Souchong was a smoking tea that you'd smoke fish with, and I would actually brew it and drink it. And it had this smoky campfire kind of nose to it. It had a finish. Gunpowder tea is a hand-rolled tea that is also very smoky. Those kinds of teas are what I kind of lean toward. I like that smoky finish. And then in coffee, I tend to go toward a dark roast, even though I like the characteristics of some coffees milder. I tend to go dark roast, a little bit smokier. Yeah. So when I'm doing bourbon, my tendency is to lean towards something that has kind of a leathery, dry leather and smoke finish on the back end of it.
You would prefer like Islay scotches.
Yeah, I do. I do like those. I'm not so much for Lapsang Souchong. Scotch Lafroig.
Yeah, Lafroig would probably be our bag.
Those are a little bit heavy on it, but I'll drink them, especially if I got a mild cigar. If I got a mild cigar, I want a smoky scotch.
We definitely have those. So you guys, I was reading up for this tonight, because I got to tell you, I know next to nothing about bourbon. I am when it comes to the actual making part. So it sounds like you guys do it a little bit different than other people do.
Well, we're a craft distillery, and in saying that, there's a lot of craft distilleries that are out there that, you know, I think Willett was a craft distillery till just a couple of years back. Wilderness Trail was a craft distillery until this past year, I believe. And they were producing like mega amounts of bourbon as a craft distillery. We produced 2 barrels a day.
That's not a lot.
Most distilleries sweep up off the floors more than we make.
Yeah.
And it takes us a 10-hour shift to do 24-hour shift to do 2 barrels a day. 10-hour shift does a barrel. And so it's a second 10-hour shift that does the second barrel. And there's about 2 hours on each end of those runs that are cleanup.
Yeah.
But so, we're expanding. We are going bigger. We've got some stills on order. And these particular stills are Vendomes, which are the finest still manufacturer in the world, is Vendome. And it's right here in Louisville, Kentucky, about 3 blocks from where I'm at right now sitting.
Nice.
And they do an incredible job on their stills. They're very expensive. We call them the Rolls Royce of stills because that's what they cost, as much as a Rolls Royce.
I can imagine.
We're putting 2 of those in. We just upgraded our gin still from a 35-gallon gin still to a 55-gallon gin still. And we're making this Bowling and Birch gin, which is phenomenal. And I know most people are bourbon drinkers, but when they get a passion like Mr. Beam has, and I say his passion is plants because he's a Purdue University graduate, master degree in landscape architecture and horticulture. And he put that master degree with a master distiller, and you get all sorts of awards for your Bowling and Birch gin 6 months when it hit the shelf.
But that's gins are a big thing. I've noticed that a lot of the upstart, not to call you guys an upstart, but like whenever, we just got a new distillery up in Birmingham. And basically, I guess while they're waiting for their juice, they were doing, a lot of places do, they do the gin and the rum. Because that's typical, like you can make that and sell it, or moonshine. You can make that and sell it to get you to the point when you have to wait 4 years basically before your first batch of juice is ready, right?
Yeah. And we started out with this product right here, which was corn whiskey.
Yeah.
That's where the distillery started out. And 6 months after he turned the stills on, he took his first gold medal. That's our first run of that product from the distillery. Still got a little shot of it for emergency purposes. Yeah. So, we started out in corn whiskey, and then we moved into sugar shine, which was a traditional Appalachian moonshine. And it got us recognized. I tell you, one of the people that recognized it was Tim Smith from the show Moonshiners. Uh-huh. Tim Smith came to the distillery, and he went through unannounced. Probably didn't even know who he was the first time he came through. Second time he came through, he kind of got recognized. And by the third time that he came back, he said to Steve Beam, "You're making the most realistic moonshine, the real deal. If this was in the Appalachian Mountains, I'd think I was drinking straight off of the still.
Yeah,
Sugarshine is the real deal, and I want to go legal with my Climax Moonshine." So he engaged Steve Beam to take him legal off of his DSP. We were the rectifier. He was the rectifier. We were the distilling producing agent.
That's
so we produced Climax Moonshine.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's really cool. This is absolutely fascinating to me. All of this stuff. I think it is so cool. So. When you look at the mash bills, and all of the differences, what all goes into a mash bill? Because there's like there's so many different ratios out there, right? How do you choose what grains to use? Because, you know, versus, I guess, wheat versus corn. I guess I think like Buffalo Trace is real wheat heavy. And there's a couple others like McKenna that's real wheat heavy. And then y'all are very, very corn heavy. But how do you choose what grains to use in the ratios?
Well, I tell you, we have a Connex container, and that Connex container is filled with experimentals. Okay. And the experimental collection is Limestone Branch bourbon distillates, like this one right here. I keep going the wrong direction, don't I?
Yeah, there I know. It's backwards, and it throws me off, too. Yeah.
That looks great. I do good when it's forward. That is a bourbon distillate, and it is a handwritten on a mash bill down at the bottom.
Yeah.
It is in a 375 bottle, and it came out of a 15-gallon barrel. Now, a 15-gallon barrel is a quarter cask.
Yeah.
So a 15-gallon barrel is just about the exact liquid-to-wood ratio as a 53. And a 15-gallon barrel costs you as much within a few dollars of a 53-gallon barrel.
That's crazy. But
what it does is it gives a master distiller an opportunity to see what his distillate's going to taste like in 2 years versus six. So this particular one that I have in my hand is 22 months old. So it is Kentucky straight bourbon whiskey.
Yeah.
Because it's 2 years and a day in the cask in Kentucky, distilled in Kentucky. Yeah. If I had left that in the cask for 4 years, then I could have gone with bottled and bond, done in one season with one distiller, and this could be a bottled and bond from our distillery out of a 15-gallon barrel. That 15-gallon barrel produces an incredible flavor profile, but it's not identical to the flavor profile of a 53. But for a master distiller, he can see a view into the future as to exactly what his distillate could taste like in just 2 years. And if it's real popular in our gift shop, because that's where we sell these single barrels. So we sell a ton of wheated. If we sell a ton of wheated, what's the plan? The plan is possibly to put that into full production in 53-gallon barrels using our customers' taste buds as the direction of where our distillery is going to go in the future.
That's
so to answer your question, we have all sorts of mash bills in that Connex container, and we sell them through the gift shop. We have a rye. It's 100% rye.
Wow.
How the hell do you even get a conversion on 100% rye without
any malt? I have no idea. Yeah.
You have to malt the rye. The most expensive thing a distillery could possibly ever make is 100% malted rye whiskey.
Yes.
And that's available in our gift shop to taste periodically. When I find a barrel that's just perfect, I'll bring it in and we'll sell it through the gift shop. And it's very unique and different in its flavor and characteristics. Has a spicy front end and a creamy finish on the back end. We have a 28% red wheat, 60% corn, 13, and then the rest in malted barley. So 2860 is another mash bill, which is a wheater, like Maker's Mark or Pappy Van Winkle, Weller 12-Year, Rebel Yell, all those wheated bourbons. And that one is sold so well that we have put it into 53-gallon barrels. And it's sitting on aging out to 6 to 7 years. And we're going to see what it tastes like. And if it's as good as it is in the 15s, then it could possibly be a skew of Yellowstone in the future. Not only would you have the typical Yellowstone, which is the high corn content of Yellowstone Select, you may have another name, or Yellowstone Wheater. You know, we could call it Wheater. Really cool. I like it.
Yeah. I think that you should call it the Wheater. I think that'd be a great name.
It's a beautiful name.
Yeah,
and that's the highest wheat content of any bourbon distillate I've ever heard of, 28% red wheat. I don't know of a bourbon that has a higher wheat content than that. There might be out there.
But that's one of the things that I like about Yellowstone is you guys seem to kind of push the envelope of what's been done. And you're like, not that you're doing crazy things, but you're doing different things to kind of, you know, I mean, like, there's so many of these bourbons that are the same bourbons that were, you know, being sold 30 years ago, you know, and they haven't changed anything. And you guys are, it seems like you guys are kind of cutting edge for in an industry that's really built on a ton of tradition. And I think that I think that's really cool. And I think go ahead.
You got a seventh generation Beam at the helm of the ship.
Right.
And that seventh generation Beam, his daddy was a Beam, Jimmy Beam. And then his daddy was a Beam, you know, it goes all the way back to Jacob. And if you go back to a Minor Case Beam, his great grandfather had a distillery in Gethsemane, Kentucky, making Old Trump whiskey. And he was up against his cousin, his first cousin, Colonel James Beauregard Beam himself.
Yeah.
So you've got the history in this distillery of things that have been done in the past that are understood by a seventh generation Beam that, you know, it's no better person to put on the ship's helm than a Beam. That's for damn sure.
So how does
seven major distilleries?
So how does that work? Because he's a Beam. And then how many Beams are making bourbon right now?
That's a daggone good question. Well, you got some No Boys over there, Freddie No and Fred Jr. Those are both Beams from the mama's side of the family. If you go back to Booker No, Booker's mother was a Beam.
Yeah.
And that's how that lineage comes
and
into play.
That's Booker's.
That's Booker's.
And Baker, isn't Baker's a Beam?
Baker's, Basil Hayden, all those. Baker Beam. It's Baker Beam. Yeah. And if you get over to Heaven Hill Distillery, well, you had Parker Beam, then you had Craig Beam, and then, you know, the lineage, it actually went back a little bit further than that. I do believe that it was a coin toss between who would go over to Heaven Hill and who would stay at Jim Beam.
Yeah,
between some of the Beam brothers. The Beam brothers took a coin toss and said, well, okay. And then that finalized which Beam was going to be Heaven Hill's distiller. And it's gone way, way back with Heaven Hill since the beginning. From the very beginning of Heaven Hill was a Beam until just recently when Craig has stepped off as a master distiller and he's gone back to his farming. He runs a cattle ranch called Sunbeam Farm. And he was always into his cows, just like his daddy was. Nothing would light Parker up more than talk about his Black Angus cows. He would. He was a farmer first, I believe.
I like the Black Angus cows a lot more. I like them when they're on my plate. You know, I like that.
You know, that's a fact too.
Yeah,
that's. I bet bourbon.
I bet they have some really good steaks. I mean, because their bourbons are incredible. I bet their steaks are incredible too. Especially with all that corn you guys have, because it's like corn fed.
You get over there with Fred and his daddy Booker. Booker was always about the ham. He would take and put his hams in the barrel house, and all that angel share would soak into that ham. And he made some serious country ham. He used to take it with him on trips. I remember a story that I heard from Fred in a podcast that I was listening to about how Booker just embarrassed the shit out of him one night. They went to a fine dining restaurant, and I believe it was in Chicago, and they sat down, and Booker ordered ham, and the guy brought the chef, you know, sent the ham out, and he tasted through a couple slices of it, and he said, "That's not ham." He said, "Fred, go get that ham out of my trunk." And Fred had to get up from the table and go out and get his country ham and bring it in. And he said, "Go get that chef. I want to show him what country ham is about."
Oh, no.
And he started slicing country ham for everybody in the restaurant.
Oh, no.
Of course, he was Booker. I mean, Booker got away with it. He was the real deal, and he's bigger than life. And I bet that chef took note, because that country ham was probably a lot better than what was on that plate.
Oh, I bet. What kind of deal do you think that the Beam family made with somebody to be so good at making bourbon? Is this like a devil went down to Georgia, you know, and they got, instead of a golden fiddle, they got the golden mash bill, you think?
I think it goes back to the days when you had farms and you were making corn whiskey out of whatever was remaining out of your crop. And those Bean boys just knew how to make some good corn whiskey back in its day. And then they decided to make a job out of it. And when your daddy is doing something that's successful and you're able to apprentice him, then you are able to make something successful. When you have as many kids as they did, they had huge families, 10 kids and Steve's grandfather's family. There's 10 of them, and most of them had become distillers. Well, I was growing up here in Kentucky. There were 7 major distilleries throughout the majority. I mean, just great big distilleries. You didn't have any small distilleries after Prohibition. It pretty much killed all of them off. And there were 7 of them that remained. And 6 out of the 7 of those distilleries employed a Beam as their distiller or master distiller over the years. And I relate 68 different bourbons, and I'm sure it's more than that, back to a Beam family distiller. And now it's growing because we are a Beam-founded distillery ourselves.
Right.
And so you got Steve Beam growing that. And at that time, when Steve decided to open Limestone Branch Distillery, there was no longer a Beam family owner of a distillery. And that's a distinction. There was very few Beams that ever owned their distilleries. And so a lot of Beams work for distilleries, but very few of them ever owned their distilleries. Steve built this place from the ground up.
And they're closing it. This was the 2020 was what, the 225th year of the Beam family? Because I was looking on your website, said that they started in 1795.
Yeah, Jacob. All the way back in Pennsylvania with Jacob.
Yeah,
B-O-E-H-M, German family. Yeah. He was born in Pennsylvania, but his family was from Germany.
That's just so crazy. I mean, I knew bourbon was old, but 225 years of doing this, they've probably picked up a thing or two. Do they ever have you go to a lot of these winemakers and the wineries and stuff, and they're like, oh, we have these bottles from whenever they started. Do these distilleries? Do a lot of them still have a lot of the or at least some of the old, like some of their first batches laying around that they keep around?
Not as much as they used to, would probably like, I'm sure. Not as much as they probably like.
Yeah.
I'm sure that if you went over and saw Max Shapira and you went to Max's office, I bet he could pull something out of his desk drawer that would be able to blow your mind. Because he's got some of the largest stocks.
So what's the oldest that you've tried?
Well, I've tasted a lot of old dusties. A friend of mine here in Kentucky had the Haymarket Whiskey Bar, Matthew Landon. And Haymarket had an extensive stock of old dusties. He's got a huge bunker. And, getting a chance to taste what it tasted like in the old years. And then occasionally we'll have somebody come by that wants to sit down with us and do a taste of something that they've got that's special to them. And so we get an opportunity to drink some really old juice. And it's different. I'm telling you, I don't think that there's a distillery today that can make what was made yesteryear for several different reasons. One of them was they were on aquifers. And they weren't on, public water. And, your reverse osmosis waters and things like that that you do today to make sure that you don't impart any extra flavor into it, that changes it. There's a lot of different things that were done in the old days that would never pass as inspections today.
That
gave that bourbon a very unique and different flavor from yesteryear. That's my personal opinion.
So what's like the most, the like, what's the one that you've had that's like the oldest that, or like the best, that you've tried that's just like wild or out there?
I had a J.W. Dant that was brought in and we tasted it, and it was like 24 years old, something like that. And it was absolutely phenomenal. It was literally some of the best bourbon I've ever drank. And we got an opportunity to, crack that bottle and see what that tasted like from the old distillery. It would have been distilled down in Gethsemane. at the at the Cold Spring Distillery back in that that many years back. I believe that's what Steve was telling me. That would have been from the distillery down in Gethsemane. You understand what's happening in Gethsemane right now?
I am not. I know it was the garden where Jesus prayed.
Wally Dant is building a $100 million distillery build called the Log Still Distillery. Wally's great-grandfather was J.W. Dant. And J.W. Dant distilled his first rum off a poplar tree, a tree he had fell, split in two, coppered in, hollowed out and coppered in, fermented off of and distilled off of the log. So Wally's calling his distillery the Log Still Distillery down in Gethsemane, Kentucky. Now, Wally's great-grandfather is Stephen Paul Beam's great-grandfather. Though these boys were Beams all their lives, the mother was a Dant that whole time. I like to say our distiller wasn't born, he was distilled.
Yeah. So, all right, so I have, so going off of this whole old thing, right? So a lot of people say that, you know, bottles, once you open the bottle, that you lose a lot of the flavor and that basically the bourbons don't age in the bottle. Is that true, or is that kind of just a wives' tale that people have told to make themselves feel better about not having bottles on their shelves that are unopened and they're just collecting?
You know, a bottle that's unopened, as long as the cork hadn't failed, you're going to have probably a pretty good pour. As long as it has not been stored in high heat, sunlight, if it's been in a cabinet someplace and it's been packed up where it's at a room temperature for all those years and you're not getting a bunch of temperature influxation on that bottle, you're probably going to have a pretty clean and pristine taste coming off of that bottle. Now, if it's been uncorked and three quarters or a quarter of the bottle's gone, then what we do for those old dusties at the distillery is we put glass marbles in it, clean glass marbles. And what those glass marbles will do will bring that liquor up around that neck so that you don't get as much oxygenation coming into the actual bottle itself. If you keep the liquid up in the neck of it, then it won't have but just a very minute amount of oxygenation. And you want to make sure that your corks aren't failing. You know, corks do fail. So you want to make sure that it has a proper cork in it that will keep it from aging. But yeah, other than that, you should be able to keep bourbon for years and still have a pristine flavor.
So when, everybody does charred oak basically right now. I think, I feel like it's all charred oak. Why do you use charred oak for the
bourbon hat? That's part of it. Being America's native spirit, one of the regulations is it has to go into a new charred American oak barrel.
Okay.
And so, all barrels are American oak charred. And one-time use. You can't reuse a bourbon barrel. It's not the Tennessee whiskey. Tennessee whiskey can be done in a used bourbon barrel. You can only use it one time. And so a lot of people have their preference on char, too. If you talk and you visit the Cooperage there in Lebanon, right up the street from us, which is a highly recommended tour, you come down and you go into Independent Stave and you get to tour and see how they fire the barrels, how they build them, how they tear them apart, how they repair them. The hardest working job in the entire bourbon industry is Cooper. I mean, they're building these barrels at phenomenal amounts and quantities, up to 800 barrels a day for somebody that is extraordinary in their craftsmanship. They have done that many barrels in one day, just a, you know, a single group of guys. Amazing to me that you could bring up that many barrels. And then the distiller decides what kind of the char is going to be. He'll, you know, do some different things, probably do some experiments. They have an entire experimental, facility at Independent Stave. I did a tasting panel with them. I was, brought on board by Andrew Weebrink, and, we went down and I taste, bourbons that were coming out of spiral cut barrels. A spiral cut barrel adds a little bit more surface area for the actual alcohol to penetrate the wood. And then we did some toasted barrels. And Independent Stave in Missouri does what we call specialty barrels. And so Independent Stave in Lebanon, Missouri is where we get our barrels. Because the Yellowstone barrels are toasted first, which is a slow flame inside the barrel for a long period of time where it just toasts it like the outside of a marshmallow. And then we take and put a three char on top of that toast. And so Yellowstone is being finished in specialty barrels from Independent Stave, Missouri. Toasted and charred at a three level.
That's I'm learning everything here because I wouldn't have known that because like that's become the toasted barrel has become kind of the new, that's become a popular item for a lot of people.
You know, it adds a layer of flavor to the bourbon that you just wouldn't get if you didn't.
Yeah. Cause they, Elijah Craig, they just came out with their toasted barrel. Michter's was doing the toasted barrels that have been very popular.
Maker's Mark does a French oak stave. Maker's Mark puts Maker's 46. They put the French oak staves in after they open a barrel of Maker's and add it for an additional 6-8 months. I'm not sure exactly how long, but that gives it a unique and different flavor profile from Maker's Mark. Just and adding those staves in there.
And then there's so many different barrels that a lot of people they finish. So you have to be can it so you have to age it in the oak barrels, but can you like put it in a different barrel too?
If you do, it's called a specialty bourbon. At that point, at the moment that you add it to a different barrel, it's then considered a specialty bourbon. And in doing so, you can no longer put an age statement on your bourbon. So if you're putting a 12-year-old bourbon in a French Armagnac cask, and you're aging it out after the dump of the Armagnac, and you're aging it out for an additional 6 months to give it unique and different flavors on the back ends of it, you're then going to call it a specialty bourbon, and it will not have an age statement.
That's okay. So, and your stuff is all 4 to 7 years. Y'all are coming up on your, you opened in 2012, or I guess it opened in 11. You broke ground. So in a year and a half, y'all are going to be at 10 years. Are you guys having some 10-year bourbon hopefully coming out in the next couple of years?
Well, you have to understand that we started the distillery doing what? Moonshine.
Yes.
So those first years, we didn't put back too much bourbon.
Right.
But yeah, we do a little bit deeper dive into Mr. Beam's expertise in blending and doing, and his finishes and things like that. He stretches himself once a year with a limited edition. And some of those limited editions have been 9-year-olds and 9 and 12-year-old mingles. And it just depends on what he's, into that particular year.
Sure.
This past year, 2020, it was finished off in French Armagnac casks, which is what I brought up earlier. Armagnac is a cognac, but it's from the region of Armagnac. It's a little harder to come by and a little more expensive. So he used those casks once they were dumped and finished his 2020 limited edition in that particular cask, which gave it a phenomenal flavor and finish. And so that bourbon was about 10,500 bottles, and it was released, and it's one-time release, never to be made again. And the Black Label limited edition that comes out in the fall of the year, and he always tries to do something not special.
This one.
Yeah, that one. Yeah. Which one is it? 18, 19?
This one is the 18.
Yeah, 2018 was one of my favorite bourbons we ever produced.
That was the wine casks.
It finished off in a used wine cask, and it was used for bourbon. It was never used for wine.
That's
the very
crazy.
First limited edition that he did in that cask was 2016, and it was finished in a toasted wood wine cask. So they toast wine cask rather than char them. So he took a brand new toasted wood wine cask, put his 2016 bourbon in there, and aged it at an additional like 9 months, and it gave it a toasted wood finish like no other bourbon I'd ever tasted. Well, what'd he do with the cask? Well, he took it back to the cooperage and had a one char fired over top of that 2016 bourbon that had been cask, embedding it into the wood right after the dump, and then put the 2017 Limited in that cask. That was bourbon on bourbon. Once he dumped that cask, once he finished with the 2017, he took the cask immediately back to the cooperage, had a three char fired over top of it. The gold medal award winning 2017 bourbon was embedded in with the 16. So the 2018 bourbon that you have in that cat is a bourbon on bourbon on bourbon. The complexities of which I've never tasted before. That's an incredible bourbon.
My wife drank it real quick. So it
God
was
bless
real
her.
Quick. She loves
I don't
it.
Blame her a bit.
And Yellowstone's become it's become one of our favorites around here. Mostly because the reason that we got into it was because of the Yellowstone show.
Right.
Which is a fantastic show.
I don't know. We've got a big spend on that show this year for commercials. And we did a spend on it last year. And what we found out was that the largest growing segment in the whiskey and bourbon buying is women. And,
yes.
And who knew that when Kevin Costner would be on a show that they'd swoon and buy
right?
all of all bourbon? We ran out of the glass within the first 6 months. Well, that was about 8 months into the year. We were completely out of glass. We couldn't put any more bourbon anywhere because we had no glass to put it in. So this year we've doubled our orders on our glass, maybe even tripled them. I'm not sure. And we are advertising on the show again this year. So you will see our commercials in the front end of all those episodes.
Well, and I was bummed because we were watching it and he grabs a bullet. I think he grabbed a bullet bourbon and I'm like, man, like if he, like we
he,
need him.
He did that. He did that. We got to get somebody to get. You know, that's a fact.
Yeah. So the show, that's really, I mean, I shouldn't be surprised. I think that it's the women demographic for a lot of things is changing a lot. We see it in the cigar industry a lot.
I have a lot of times I'll have a pour on a porch with a few guys and their ladies. And those ladies will fire up a cigar right alongside of us and enjoy the heck out of it and proud for it.
I am too. I
drinking
mean, my
barrel strength bourbons.
Yes.
They're not drinking that light stuff. They're drinking the, you know, the barrel strengths and their palates are more sophisticated than ours. They truly are. They taste more nuances than we can taste. They smell better than we can smell. They make fantastic.
My wife's giving me a look right now.
Yeah.
My wife's giving me a look.
She could probably break a bourbon down farther and deeper than I could. And I've been doing tastings for, I don't even know how many decades of years.
Yeah. It's just crazy because, you know, I think that like whenever we're at our cigar trade shows, you know, I'll tell people that, my wife wants a cigar and their natural inclination is to give her like a flavored cigar or a mild cigar. And she prefers really full body.
Maduro. Sure.
Yep. Yeah, she does. And when it comes to like, you know, drinks, she's never been like a fruity cocktail type girl. You know, she loves the other Lux Row products, the old Ezra 7 year cask strength. That's one of her favorites. She loves Yellowstone, but she likes higher proof bourbon. Like right now, I think she's drinking that 115 proof handpicked collection that you guys did, I think, for a New Jersey. I had to order it from somebody because we don't get it in Alabama. Alabama is not the home of the free for bourbon.
I know that's a fact. I've met with the Alabama control board myself. And we placed our stuff in a lot of locations, pretty much the entire state of Alabama. When they say it's good, If they say it's bad, you're out.
Yeah, it's tough.
That's
man.
The way it rolls. Control it's really states.
Tough. Yeah, it's really tough here. So when you're aging it, what do you think is the like? Is there a when you're aging bourbon? Is there a you should age it? Is like what's the ideal age? You know, for bourbon, do you think?
Or yeah, is there? That's a well? There is. To an extent, there is. 6 years is a phenomenal age for any bourbon.
Okay.
Anything past 6 years, you may go south and you may go east, meaning yeah. it might get better, it might go worse. If you go to 8 years and something has gone bad at seven, at 8 years, it might come completely back around and be phenomenal again. So bourbon is not like wine. It depends on where it is at the stage it's in and when you want to pull it. And that's where your barrel house manager really comes into effect. He tastes through these things and finds them at their perfect stage and then pulls the barrel at that stage and uses it for whatever it's going to end purpose is going to be.
And then some of the barrels at, so like barrel A is ready at seven, but barrel B might not be ready at seven. What happened?
That's correct.
So do you, so if you have, so like what a barrel's 53, so you get what 240 cases or 240 bottles per barrel, somewhere
that's
between.
That's about right. Depends on how old the barrel is.
Yeah. So if you have like, so say you have like five barrels, would you do like a 1,000 bottle run of that product or.
That'd be a small batch run.
Yeah.
Yeah, you might sell it as a single barrel. You might sell it as a small batch, and you might blend it in with something that's much larger. If it's not, you're not going to throw any of it away. If there's something that's not of the greatest quality, then you're going to blend it in with a much larger blend and make it disappear. Typically, there's just not much that you don't want to eliminate a barrel by any means. Sure. But
no,
it happens, but it doesn't happen very often.
So you're saying about 6, 7, 8 years is probably the sweet
spot?
Yeah.
Sweet spot.
Yeah.
Anything 6 years, 7, 8 years past that, it's just, it will be what it will be past that.
Yeah.
Might turn out wonderful. In 14 years, you might find one that's phenomenal, but you're going to have so much angel share loss. And you're going to get such little juice out of that barrel at that stage that, it's almost a crime that you wasted all that good juice from a few years back.
Yeah. So what separates Yellowstone juice from other Beam family juice? Like what's the, like, if you could put it on, like, what's the distinguishing thing that makes Yellowstone, what it is compared to the other things?
Well, anything that, the Beam boys have made, from whatever distillery that they're making at, would probably, be wonderful to drink. At the same time saying that, it's your mash bills, it's your distiller. It's your equipment, it's your location, it's the flavor profile coming off of your particular distillery because of its environmental aspects that come into play. I don't care if you're distilling the exact same mash bill at Limestone Branch Distillery and you take it over to Claremont, Kentucky, and you distill it over there, it's going to be a different juice coming off the stills and flavor profile. If for no other reason than Claremont has different pollens and things in the air than what we have over in Lebanon, Kentucky. Their aquifer is different than what our aquifer is in Lebanon, Kentucky. There's a ton of different environmental aspects that you got to think about that influences the final flavor profile of a bourbon. I don't know how many chemical aspects there are to it, but there's a ton.
So do you use a specific water in the distilling process?
Yeah, you always, anytime that you're proofing something down, you're using a reverse osmosis water, which is stripping everything out of it so you don't impart any flavor into it. All you're doing is adding a little bit of water to proof it down to the proof that you want it at. And what I have found is proof influences the flavor profile as much as the distiller or the barrel house manager. So what you're tasting at 93 proof is not going to be the same flavor profile and characteristics that you get out of 102, and then you get up to 115 and you're closer to barrel strength, you're going to turn the volume up each time you go up, and all of the characteristics of that barrel are going to pop when you get up there to those higher proofs. And sometimes right. They pop good and sometimes they pop bad. You might find that you find all the flaws in that particular barrel when you get up to those higher strengths, where when you were tasting it at a lower strength, it was a phenomenal bourbon and everything was good. But then you got up to, 109, 115, and you started tasting some off things about that particular barrel that you didn't like. Taste a barrel that was sitting next to it, same rickhouse, same location. You taste it at 102 and it's not any good at all. It's just weak and watery and you don't have any flavor characteristics. You turn the volume up, you go up to 115, and all of a sudden that's a phenomenal freaking barrel. So proof influences the flavor profile dramatically in anything that you do in bourbon.
And I've always found that fascinating. And we typically, I typically at R&R, when I typically try to start people off at lower proof. And that's why one of the things I like about the Yellowstone is that it's a 93, which is, I think, a real sweet spot for somebody that's getting into bourbon drinking, that a lot of times people will drink it and they'll say, man, that's some fire water, And I think the 93 and 86, 90, basically that's kind of the sweet spot, I think, for the beginners, because it's like with cigars, I don't want to give somebody that's never smoked a cigar before. I don't want to say, oh, why don't you try this, double Ajero Maduro? Cause they're going to get sick and they're going to say, oh, this is too strong and not like cigars and probably not come back, but if I start them off in something, lighter, easier to smoke. And that's, I think bourbon, there's a lot of similarities between the two there. And I think it's very cool. The bourbon, how well bourbon and cigars go together. And I always tell people, ask me all the time, what bourbon should I drink when I'm smoking a cigar? And I always tell them, truthfully, you should smoke you should drink the bourbon that you like the most while you're smoking a cigar. But this is what we like. So it's a very cool thing.
I like to smoke opposite of what I'm drinking. I am drinking a very barrel strength bourbon that's really full flavored and strong in its characteristics, I'm going to go with a light cigar. And if I'm drinking something that's light, like Yellowstone, and I might go with something a little darker in the cigar that's a little bit more spicy. I like to go to the opposite ends of what the beverage is giving me versus what I want for the cigar.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense.
It enhances it.
Yeah, it's like people that like milder cigars and they want a really strong cup of coffee with it because it enhances. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So when you're picking out bourbon, what are you like, because you're like a God about bourbon, like what do you look for when you're picking out bourbons on the shelf if you're trying to find a new bottle to start drinking?
Well, reviews on it, some of it is toward the reviews as to what people have said that they like or dislike about it. If it's popular, I want to try it to see why everybody's raving about it. So I'm going to grab a bottle of stuff that's pretty flavorful. And, you know, then there's other things that are unique that I've heard, you know, other people in the industry say, hey, you know, have you tried this McKenna 10 Year? This McKenna 10 Year is my favorite go-to bourbon. And when that happens, well, I got to get me a McKenna 10 Year and see why they like it so much. And and then, you know, they podcast it and you can't find it anymore.
That happens so, a lot, man.
Yeah. And then there's like Johnny Drum. I mean, Johnny Drum is a wax coated, similar to what Maker's Mark does. They dip it in wax and it's a Willett product. And, you know, most people don't recognize it as a Willett product, but that's one of my go-tos. Like it a lot. If you figure out what your mash bill that you truly like the most too is a big deal. When you're drinking a bourbon, always try to find what the mash bill was on that particular bourbon, so that if you really like it, then you can go to the next distillery and say, hey, you got any high corn content bourbons? I really like Yellowstone Select and it's like 75% corn. Do you have anything that high in corn?
Yeah.
And then you taste something from another distillery that's of that high of a corn content. And because you've already liked Yellowstone, you're probably going to already like what they're producing. Not well, necessarily, that's what I like about, probably.
I always like it when they put, when the bottles have the mash bill on it. I think that's cool. That way,
Majority of our stuff does.
Yes. Yes. And that's good because you can go and say, like you said, go say, I prefer wheat bourbons. I prefer corn bourbons, you know, and
rye, heavy rye. Let's go with higher rye content.
Yeah. I've seen like what you were talking about with the reverse osmosis. I've seen even people start talking about the water that they're using. I guess charcoal filtered water is becoming kind of a thing for some distilleries to give it a little bit distinct flavor. I think New Riff, their bottled and bond, I think, was with the charcoal filtered water.
That's interesting. I got to get over there and check them out again.
Yeah. And that's a cool, the Party Source people, I went there one time. When we were up there in Cincinnati, because we're big Reds fans. And unfortunately, we're big Reds fans, but we're big Reds fans nonetheless. But we went up to the Party Source, and it was like a damn Walmart. And this was like right after they had just built the distillery. They didn't even have their bourbons yet. They just had whatever they were making at the time. But that place is unreal. They have a big cigar selection there. They're one of the biggest cigar retailers in the U.S.
We've got a great guy in there too.
Yeah, yeah.
He's very sharp with his cigars. I bought cigars from him before, and they just came down last week and bought a barrel of Yellowstone. So that's going to be in their store here very shortly.
Well, I'll have to go up when it's available. But R&R, I believe. R&R is going to be having their own barrel here later in the year. So when I go pick my barrel, what do I need to be looking out for to make sure that the R&R barrel is one of those podcasted barrels so that I sell out of the R&R barrel?
Well, you want to take and come to the distillery, do a hand-picked barrel.
Yeah.
And you and I'll go through and pick the barrel together.
All right. Then what are we looking for with the R&R barrel? Like when you're doing the barrel picks and you're picking a barrel for your bar, you know, what are the important things that you're looking for when you're picking?
What happens when this
tastes good, this tastes better, this tastes the best. Is that it? Is it really as simple as that?
Well, it can be that simple. It can be more complex than that. It all depends on, you know, first of all, you check it if you like it. Second of all is to find out which one you like the best out of the ones that have been picked. But third, you have to understand that all those barrels were picked by Steve Beam and myself. And so they've already been picked through as being of the highest quality of the barrels that we have going toward a blend and set aside for the barrel program. So you're not going to find a dog in the hunt. All of them are going to be good. And you're just going to try to pick the best one out of the best. And that leads you into when you come across it, you will know. You just got to go through and taste them, and all of a sudden you find something that you really like about that particular barrel, and you don't even know why. And then you kind of taste it again, and then it starts showing, well, it does have a little of that smoky flavor I like on the back end. Okay, it's a little bit dry. I like that too. A little, it's got that leather-esque taste to it. And yeah. And it just comes to, after tasting through the selection, you dwindle it down to the finest of what you've got, and that's the barrel. And sometimes I had one not too long ago that went out to Kansas City, Missouri, called Smoke Wagon, because it had that smoky finish on the back of it. And then, you know, one of them was a plum bomb. It had plum flavors to it. And, you know, it just shows up, and it's amazing when it does that. And it's always a good when it really when it shows itself like that.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't know I could do that. This has been awesome. I have learned a lot tonight. Have you learned a lot tonight, babe?
I've learned a lot.
Yeah. This has been really cool, man. I'm really excited about coming up there and actually seeing what all you've been talking about tonight. And we're hoping to get up there hopefully when COVID calms down some. Fake Saban says he learned a lot tonight. Thank you so much for being on. I can't wait to come up there. I'll bring a lot of cigars with me, and we'll sit around and drink bourbon and smoke cigars. And this has been so cool.
When you book your tasting, book it for the evening, and we'll do that. There's two tastings. Typically there's a morning tasting at 9:30 a.m. and then there's a 1:30 tasting of barrels, and the 1:30 tasting is the one you want to be at.
Okay.
And heck, if it was me, I would just go ahead and book in over at the Hampton Inn right next door.
Oh, and perfect.
There's no time limit. You can just walk across the field into the Hampton.
Oh, perfect. That sounds perfect. I can't wait to get up there. Thank you so much for being on tonight.
Enjoy it. Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it so much. That is the R&R Cast, folks. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you next week.
Thanks again.